Jeremiah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thomas, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So you and I known each other for a while now. I think we met in the very early days of Quantopian, where you were advisor and helping us out just with the first steps. And I remember when you came to the office and we just sort of hit it off and talked about some cool projects that you're working on. So I'd like to basically take us there and then see how your story progressed and dive a little bit more into your background.
Absolutely. So that must have been what, 9 years ago, 10 years ago, something like that.
Yeah.
I, at the time, had left a very large hedge fund that I had worked for previously, and I oversaw risk management there. And I had gone off to do this crazy thing and build machine learning models. And again, this is what, 2011. Machine learning is the Wild West at that time. There's not a lot of agreement on what it is or how to do it or how to build tools for it. And in particular, I loved time series modeling because of my finance background. And that only recently has that even become really an understood discipline with recurrent nets and stuff. So back then, I was building a piece of software called Scarecrow, which was built on top of Theano. I was an early contributor to Theano. TensorFlow, PyTorch didn't even exist yet. And yeah, you and I met in the early days of Quantopian, and I showed you this thing. I said, hey, Thomas, I'm trying to build a framework to help machine learning researchers just prototype their models. What do you think? And you and I just started talking about building software and data science, machine learning, of course, which we have mutual interest in, and it's just a great way to hit it off.
Yeah, totally. So then I think you went on to found your own company around that and build research around that more. And so what happened with that?
Sure. So Scarecrow, the software that I built, became the basis for a business, which I guess was a consulting business at the end of the day, even though the software was a huge component of it. And I just worked for tons and tons of clients in all different industries, learning about their problems, learning about how they worked with data, and doing my best to build them solutions that applied this, again, very nascent field of machine learning to whatever business problem they had. And it was great for me in retrospect because I got this breadth of experience and exposure to the types of things that businesses really care about and the actionable things that they can do with machine learning. Because you and I both know it does us a lot of good to sit here and dream about ideal models and perfect data sets and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, all a business really cares about is moving the needle and doing something that can actually drive some value. And so this was a really great way for me to acquire that knowledge across a whole bunch of industries really fast. I then got hired by one of my clients, which was a very large family office, and I became the head of risk there. In that role, I oversaw a very diverse multi-asset portfolio, and I was charged with building all kinds of analytics and tools to oversee it. And I very quickly ran out of time to run my own analytics. I needed to automate myself. It happened at this time that a now very popular tool called Apache Airflow, then it was just Airflow, was open sourced. And I became involved in the Airflow project almost immediately. And the way I became involved was by volunteering to modernize the entire code base from Python 2 to Python 3, which I had switched to very, very early. That was how I became involved in Airflow and later became a developer of Airflow, later became a PMC member of Airflow. And I thought at the time that this tool was going to solve my automation problem. It was going to let me take all the things that I was trying to do, schedule them, forget about them, and go on and get back to building interesting analytics.
And I think that is also where we had another really interesting overlap, where at Quantopian, I was also building this data pipelining project where we would take all the algorithms on the platform and then pump them through this. So we use Luigi for this flow-like project and then populate a database with that. So a very classic data flow project. And I remember us talking about it, and I was thinking about maybe moving to Airflow because Luigi wasn't being that maintained. And one of the key things where I got really tripped up on was I thought, oh yeah, it's this data flow system where you can just pass data from one worker to the next. And you were like, well, no, that's not exactly how it works. And I was like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Like, isn't it designed to do exactly this? And so for me as a data scientist, it was really surprising that the system wasn't doing what I thought would be the main reason for its existence.
Yeah, this was like a fascinating realization for me in exactly the same way as it was for you. What you and I took for granted in our software and our tooling as data scientists would blow the mind of any data engineer 4 years ago. part of that is philosophical, because data science tooling is geared around pipelines and literally moving data through a series of transformations to get to the end. You and I would see that all the time in statistical modeling or machine learning tooling. Data engineering at the time, especially when so much of the world was geared around Hadoop-based systems, was about kicking off jobs in a remote server, waiting for them to complete and going on to the next thing. And so rather than passing data through the system, like in the data science world, they passed a very flimsy notion of state through the system. If the job succeeded, you went on to the next step. If it failed, maybe you went on to some conditional step that only triggered on failure. But the idea of actually flowing data through a system was just completely foreign. And this, for me at least, became a massive source of frustration. Once I got Airflow to automate my basics that I needed to take care of within my job, I could not easily translate the analytic work, and especially the experimental analytic work I was trying to do, into this paradigm that couldn't even understand something so basic as moving data around. And I even went so far as to write what has become a very popular Airflow feature called XCOMS in order to try to mitigate this. But I would call it a first-class hack. I worked around the dependency structure that the data engineering framework was aware of, force it to move data around, but it never even came close to matching the fluidity of the pipelining systems that we had come to love, whether it's TensorFlow, Dask, I particularly am fond of. I know you interviewed Matt Rocklin on a recent episode of this podcast, which is fantastic. There's so much there that we just take for granted as data scientists that we cannot seem to get our data engineering tool sets to accommodate.
Why do you think that there is this disconnect between data science and data engineering where they should be overlapping heavily?
I think a lot about this. In fact, one of the premises for the company that I started, Prefect, was that the philosophy of software had just diverged. And it's very sad because data science and data engineering are symbiotic. They depend on each other. They really coexist. But as a consequence of the way the tooling evolved, data engineering to orchestrate what at the time, at least 4 or 5 years ago, were these big, heavy systems, Hadoop, as I mentioned earlier, or something of that nature, whereas data science was this incredibly lightweight, flexible, experimental setup, and the software just evolved in different ways to reflect that. And now, more importantly, because, again, especially 4 years ago, there was a lot of money in data science, there was a lot of hype. Of course, we all know that it was called the sexiest job of the century or whatever.
Right.
You had giants like Google throwing money and resources into things like the TensorFlow ecosystem. So as a data scientist, if I wanted to use off-the-shelf tool, I pick up TensorFlow and I have this unbelievable wealth of data and tutorials and conferences and user interfaces and deploy systems. But if I'm a data engineer who wants the same experience, I'm out of luck. The best I can do is Airflow.
Right. So you use Airflow, you try to use Airflow, but you find it's not sufficient. What do you do then?
Well, that's sort of the big question. So I attempted to solve this problem within Airflow. I made a series of proposals. We're actually coming up on the 4-year anniversary of the first time I proposed what is now the API that you can get in my company's product, which is called Prefect, to Airflow. In many ways, Prefect started as my proposal for Airflow 2.0, and it was entirely geared around, what does Airflow need to do to accommodate the modern data science stack, which at the time was just the emergent data science stack? I couldn't get the buy-in that I needed to make those changes in Airflow. And I think that's sort of the beauty and the sorrow of the Apache model, is that Apache guarantees software stability. And so that means that someone like me can't come along and say, this is completely wrong, this is not going to fly in a few years, and change it.
Yeah.
Without convincing everybody else. And I think I was the only data scientist, or I was the only person who identified first as a data scientist on that team. And I found it difficult to make the case that this tool didn't accommodate my workflow. So that's okay, but that's the system, that's how it works. And so I went off and I got my company to approve me spending time building a workflow system for myself. And so I sat down and I said, I'm going to take everything I love about Airflow, states, failure, triggers, all this good stuff. And I'm going to take everything I love about my data science tooling. And in particular, I chose Dask because if you haven't used Dask, it's just incredible. It's the fastest way to build a pipeline in pure Python. And I just crammed them together. And I built a prototype for myself that had all of the speed, scale out, data passing, amazing features of Dask, and all of the failure, sensitivity, handling, logging, retries, all that stuff from Airflow, crammed them together. And Tinman started powering my analytics at the family office, this prototype software. And I never thought anything of it until I actually had a conversation with you and a conversation with another head of engineering at a very large company in about the span of 2 weeks by complete coincidence. And you came to me with a set of, frankly, I don't even remember what it was exactly. You came to me with some problem you were having with your Luigi setup, and you asked me how would one handle it? And it was one of those questions where the answer was, well, you just can't in the software you're using. And I said, but I have this little prototype thing I've built. Do you want to just take a look at it? And then I had the exact same conversation with this other person who came to me with an Airflow problem and said, we can't figure out how to get Airflow to do this. What do you think? And I said, you can't, but take a look at this prototype. And you both came back and you said, if this was a product, we might be interested in buying it. And that's when the light bulb went off. And I said, maybe this problem that I'm feeling that I can't seem to convince the Airflow team is real is actually felt by other people in industry who have primarily data science driven work. And I got on the phone. This is in late 2017. Mm-hmm. And I got on the phone and I just started calling just about everyone I could, everyone I knew. And I actually recently, for one of our investors, I dug up a slide that I made. Said I had 50 calls, two-thirds of which ended in someone saying they'd be interested in buying a piece of software like the one I was describing. And so that was enough.
That's amazing validation.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And I have all these details on their use cases and stuff. And I, armed with that, I went back to my firm and I pitched the idea that there was this thing to do. And the most interesting thing, and I think something that we want to get into, is the idea of what did they want to buy? And the truth is, even though the initial sort of gut reaction was, if this was a product, we'd buy it. That turned out not to be what the value was. The value was not the tooling. The value was not the software. The value, the thing people wanted to buy, was some form of guarantee around the execution of their data engineering and data science pipelines or analytics or whatever the case may be. And so what emerged from that was this objective of creating a hybrid open source proprietary product. This is a very hard balance. And we always knew from day one that you have to get it right. If you open source everything, you have no opportunity to in good faith, say to somebody, well, we worked really hard on this. We'd appreciate if you pay us for it. That's not going to fly. You open source the whole thing. That's ridiculous. On the other hand, if you keep everything closed source, you and I both know as folks who have spent a lot of time in the open source world, that's a ridiculous way to go too. Because yes. You give up so many of the wonderful benefits of open source, and you have to work extra hard to get anybody to trust you and trust the quality right. of your work. So that balance is hard.
Yeah. And especially for someone like me, even if that option is superior, I probably would never even evaluate it because there are other open source libraries, which are not by a long shot as good of a fit like Airflow, but that is who you're competing with. So if you're competing with open source, it needs to be open source as well.
Yeah, that's a really good piece of insight. The friction of getting someone to try something is high if they can't just go git clone and start, or you know, Docker run or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and I do remember us having this conversation about open source and how to open source and which parts to open source. So how did you come down to that and how difficult was that decision process?
It was a difficult process, trying to figure out what was the appropriate way to cut it. And so I remember having conversations with you. You have always been on the side of open source more. Obviously, some of our advisors have always been on the side of open source less because, right. you know, there's this assumption, which I, in all honesty, kind of disagree with, that if you keep something back, you can charge somebody for it. People aren't dumb. You can't just charge them just because it's not open source. That's not how it works. But in the early days, we decided this. We decided anything related to our engine, to the execution, to the definition of a workflow, that should all become open source. And anything that we think requires an opinionated infrastructure, that's going to stay with us. That's going to become our platform. And the thing that we're going to sell is that opinion. We are going to build the best damn infrastructure for running this stuff, the best API, the best UI. We're going to make sure that this works perfectly. And in doing so, align with what the very early user research showed, that what people really are interested in paying for is a guarantee. They're interested in paying for an insurance product. They're not at all interested in paying for software or the ability to write code. So we're going to give away the framework for defining everything, and we're going to build internally the platform that lets us orchestrate it. That was the original conception of Prefect. As you know, as the world now knows, that has evolved very recently, which is super exciting for us. But that was how we initially drew the line in a way that we thought was maximally in line with the users we were in touch with and also our goals as a young company.
Okay, so maybe we'll take a step back and look at much more precisely what the functionality of Prefect is. So you have the data flow and you can very easily define modules and transfer functions that pass data through. And then you have the orchestration layer. Could you say more about that?
Sure. So there are two major components here. One is, how do you tell the system what you want done? And the second is, how do you go about doing it? And one of our bets at Prefect, and this gets validated every single time we talk to somebody, is that people hate writing this type of code. People love to work on the things that they're trained and hired to do, right? You love building models. I love building models. I hate writing code to schedule my models. I hate writing code to trap errors in my models and retry them. I literally hate doing it. If I have to write code to do it, I'm frustrated. I'm being distracted from something I care about. So at Prefect, we distinguish between those two. We call one positive engineering. That's the thing I was hired to do. That's the thing I want to do. And then we have negative engineering, which is all the necessary work to make sure that the positive engineering can take place. That's the scheduling, the retries, the deploy, the orchestration, logging, all of this sort of what I would describe as risk management for code. You have to do it, but you really, really don't want to. And very often what happens is it'll fall to the data scientist to do the positive work and the data engineer to do the negative work. And that is a very, very fragile balance, because one of the outcomes of that that we have seen over and over and over, especially when it comes to systems like Airflow, is that the data engineer ends up discovering the problem, if they discover it at all, that only the data scientist is really equipped to solve. So just as an example, let's say you or I develop a model, we work with a data engineer to put it into production, it goes out into the world, and then it encounters a very specific and potentially arcane problem. Maybe it's a misspecified parameter. Maybe it's an unparsable bit of data. Who knows what it is? We don't even know if it's going to have a meaningful error message. But you or I, we're now divorced from the deploy of the software. So the data engineer, whose expertise is the deploy, but not the actual model itself and the problems it may encounter, is now put in the position where they must A, discover that an error took place, B, interpret the error and decide if it's a real problem, C, know that you or I is the person to contact in order to get this thing fixed, and then D, communicate back to us the circumstances in which it arose so that we can try to debug it and replicate it. So at all four of those points, you have an opportunity for failure. You might not see it, you might not know who to talk to, you might not know how to interpret it, you might not know how to recreate it. And so when we think about this problem, this positive negative engineering problem, part of what we want to do is we want to make it as easy as possible for the domain expert who's writing the code to also supply the instructions for the negative engineering. We want to let the data scientist say, this should be retried 5 times, and if it fails, I want an email. Or this should only run if this fails. And again, I want a Slack message if in any circumstance, whenever it's state updates. So we're trying to give that tool set to the people who are writing the positive code. And we're trying to make it as lightweight and as flexible as possible. And that's what Prefect, our open source toolkit, does. It's a framework for defining these negative engineering terms, these workflow semantics, so that I can sit there and I can use my existing tools. I can continue using TensorFlow. I can continue using any library that I am an expert in. And by using this minimal, but very flexible and configurable tool set, I can add in these workflow semantics in a super, super lightweight way. That's the framework side.
And the other reason why I think this makes so much more sense is that it always starts with a positive engineering, right? The data engineer never starts with a job and says, oh, like, I need to schedule things, and then you fill in the blanks. But it's always the data scientist who has some prototype and then wants to take that prototype into production. So you need a tool that also starts with the data scientist, which he can use or she can use, and then have that be a tool that data engineers can sort of link into and start scheduling things around.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I've worked with folks who have a setup in which the data scientist writes something, language they're comfortable with, Python or R or Julia or whatever the case may be. And then they have a team that I think would resemble data engineering whose job is actually to translate those models into a production setting, possibly in a different language, right? And this, to me, we have already gone so off the rails of what's supposed to happen here. And also, who signs up for that job? The data engineers that we work with would hate that. They are, people struggle, I think, in the same way that we did about 5 years ago to define what exactly is a data scientist. I think people struggle to say what exactly is a data engineer today. So to me, a data engineer is someone who has whose domain expertise is in data access and is sort of infrastructure agnostic in that way. So they may be an expert in how to get data in and out of, say, the relational database their company runs, or the document database their company runs, or flat files, or the pipeline that links them. This is someone whose expertise is in the movement, the tracking, the access of data and those patterns. That is not someone who wants to sit and take some potentially garbage statistical model and translate it into some fast compiled code and get it out there. That's someone who wants to sit and make sure that they have a healthy infrastructure and everything's humming along, the data's landing where it's supposed to, it's being transformed and cleaned like it's supposed to, and it's populating the models like it's supposed to. And so, again, we have this assumption at Prefect, which we just think is broken by every other tool out there, which is that nobody wants to write this code. It is not fun for anyone. It feels simple. So very few people are incentivized to sort of build a tool to generalize it away, right? Look what we're talking about, right? Scheduling something, retrying something, collecting logs. No one piece of this is hard. No one piece of this is something you'd look and say, oh, thank God the scheduling expert is here, right? Thank God the person who knows how to retry code is here. But when you put it all together and you need to keep track of it and you need to get it into a orchestration framework with a UI and scheduling and all this stuff, when you get that whole package together, the complexity can explode. And that's where the value of a tool like Prefect starts to come in. And that's why I think we see people so frustrated with Airflow and tools like Airflow the moment they try to take them away from the small number of use cases for which they were initially designed. It's because you end up starting to fight with the tool, which has very strict assumptions about what you're going to do with it. And it just becomes incredibly unpleasant if you can bend the tool at all. With Prefect, we took the other point of view. People are good at writing code, and they're generally very good at making sure their code works. In fact, one of our design principles is that if you could guarantee your code was going to work, you wouldn't need Prefect at all. And so what that means is that we need to be as invisible as possible for people to enjoy using our framework. Because nobody writes code assuming it won't work. Everybody thinks their code's going to work. So again, it all comes back to this idea of who wants to sit there writing code to assume their own code won't work. My whole career, I spent in risk management of one kind or another. So I am very comfortable assuming bad things are going to happen. But I'm a little bit crazy. Most people do not want to live in that world. And that is one of the major design principles behind Prefect. Invisible when you're writing the code, as lightweight as possible, but yielding this deep, deep, deep integration and insurance whenever something goes wrong.
Okay, so then let's go back to our story. You understand the problem, which is not fixed by current tools. You implement your own solution, and it makes a lot of sense. You start with the data scientist, and then we left it off with the question of which part to open source. And it sounds like you open sourced that first half in this initial version, where the data scientist can start implementing their workflow in it and have data flow through your framework. And then the second piece, which is all the negative engineering part, that was closed source at that point. Is that accurate?
That's basically right. The open source included the tooling for defining the negative engineering. And what we would describe as a lightweight way of running and scheduling these things and fully testing them. But we kept the platform and what we would describe as the infrastructure layer back in our, what we called our Prefect Cloud platform. And the way we drew that line, to be very explicit, is we said, if the feature requires a globally consistent state to be effective, we're going to keep it in our platform. And if we can do it in a stateless way, we're going to put it in the open source. So defining a retry is in the open source. But enforcing a retry with, for example, a maximum retry of 3 times requires a global state, because you may be trying to run that workflow from 1,000 different locations in 1,000 different geographies and 1,000 different compute environments, and we can only allow it to run 3 times. So we need a globally coordinated state. And so that's how we went out the gate with Prefect Cloud. And we began beta testing that over the summer of last year. Our first customer was actually a Fortune 100 company that literally called us up one day. They said, we love Prefect Core, the open source. We fully deployed it. We assume you're working on the orchestration layer, and we'd like to buy it right now. And so we sold it to them 3 weeks later. We had a contract in place. It was still months away from release, but it met their needs. And all of a sudden, we had this unbelievable working partner to continue building the software and make sure that it did what it was supposed to do. And over the fall of last year, of 2019, we continued to build up what we called our Lighthouse Partner Program, which was folks who came to us with a great use case. Almost always, it had to do with some friction between data science and data engineering. And we continued working with them to build out this cloud platform, which we increasingly came to view as the insurance layer, or rather the insurance guarantee that we as a company could provide to people who are building workflows with our open source tool set. About a month ago, as we're recording this at the end of March, we released cloud to the public, and it's just been phenomenal to see the adoption there. One of the things that was really important to us is to include a free tier in cloud. We called it Scheduler. And the idea being, anyone in the world should be able to use our software to run something on a schedule. It goes back to this idea of it's so easy sounding. It should be easy. But we all know it's incredibly hard to actually do in a distributed sense and distributed environment. And so one of our goals was to introduce this completely free layer a month ago. And then, in between a month ago and now, the coronavirus happened and everything changed.
Reviewing what you said, what I really liked about this is that the open source aspect really worked as it was supposed to work, right? So you have a piece of software that is useful on its own, and then you have companies using it and deploying it, and then they find, okay, so now that we have this useful piece integrated in our infrastructure, we do need this additional thing, and then they come back to you. So that is, like, I think, a great example of how open source can really be beneficial. Now, of course, the world doesn't always stay constant, and we are living in a time of the COVID-19 pandemic, which is impacting all companies to a varying extent, but definitely startups like yours, I would imagine, are especially impacted by that. So what has changed for you, and how have you responded to that?
The biggest thing that changed for us, and it actually turns out that this is not an entirely true statement, what I'm about to say, but my biggest fear for us was that our customer growth was going to slow simply as a consequence of an adverse economic environment.
No one wants to buy.
Nobody wants to buy. Within a few days of trying to validate whether or not that was true, we actually discovered emphatically that's not the case. People were desperate to buy software as long as that software saved them money. And so now we had a very interesting thing to deal with. We've always known that Prefect can save people money when they deploy cloud. That very first partner from the summer of 2019 saved hundreds of thousands of dollars by deploying cloud. We've had data points like that for months now. But in the environment we have been in thus far, it's been a bit challenging to make that the main selling point of a software. People have wanted to drive revenues, not reduce costs. So all of a sudden, we find ourselves in an environment where everybody, including us, is trying to reduce cost as fast as possible. And in retrospect, we started seeing some interesting clues, although at the time I hadn't quite picked up on them. Our sales cycles started shortening dramatically. As soon as people tried cloud, we started selling contracts within 1 or 2 days of the initial introduction, which is unusual. It usually takes us about a week, maybe two. So we suddenly find ourselves in this environment where efficiency matters more than anything to businesses. We know that we have a product that can drive efficiency. And in complete honesty, we know that as a young company, we're going to struggle to get our message out versus, well, any larger company. So we made a decision about 2 weeks ago. Let's open source a piece of our platform and get it out there and let anyone in the world begin to immediately benefit from the software we've built and the efficiencies we can drive without even talking to us. Let's just remove that piece of friction. And let's trust, as we have with our existing open source and as we have with the relationships that we have in place on our cloud, let's trust this mantra that we created internally as a company a long time ago, that our job is to deliver value, not to extract it. We've been so lucky to work with trusted companies and have trusted relationships. When we can demonstrate value to someone, they in turn have paid us. Now we're going to take sort of the ultimate leap there, and we're going to open source our platform and really put that to the test. We're going to get our software in as many hands as possible. And frankly, we're going to give absolutely no reason why someone would choose a different platform than Prefect.
So if I were your VC, I would probably say you're crazy, because you already have open sourced a tremendous piece of your software, which is the on-ramp to your product, which people then come to you and buy. So now you want to open source even more of that product, which you already successfully managed to sell. So why do that?
You know, what's funny is we never got a single piece of pushback to this approach. And there's a few reasons for that. First, what I'm describing is actually much closer to a traditional open core model than what we were doing. What we were doing before is we were offering two different products, an open source product, the framework, and a closed source product that sat next to it, but was completely different from it, which was our orchestration layer. Now, what we're doing as we move part of the orchestration layer into the open source, it looks much more like an open core platform that you might see at other companies, where you can use it on your own and deploy it yourself as much as you want. And then at some point, it may make sense either to let us just manage it, or for some of the features that we're able to offer as a consequence, again, of running this larger and more opinionated infrastructure, we can just frankly do more on our customers' behalf. So we actually didn't get much pushback. In fact, most of our investors, and remember, we were talking about this plan at probably the highest moment of panic, when everyone was sort of trying to figure out what the world looked like. Most of our investors said, this is fantastic. This will tear down any barrier that someone has to use Prefect. And we know what those barriers are. We hear them, right? People look at us and they look at something like Airflow and they say, well, Airflow is completely open source and you're not. And our response has always been, yes, but we're free and you're going to have to pay at least for some compute to run Airflow or in time. Right. And for a few people, that resonated, but for most people, that frankly didn't. And I totally understand why. And it wasn't to a point that it made us reconsider everything we were doing, but we've always known that this one opposition was out there. Airflow is a fully open source platform, and Prefect is not. So by taking this step, we were actually eliminating what I would view as the only competitive advantage of our fully open source alternative. And from that point of view, it actually became very exciting. It became more exciting when we started doing two things. We reached out to every single one of our current customers to make them aware that something that was formerly exclusive to them as paying customers of Prefect Cloud was now going to be in the open source. And the main thing there was our UI. And every single one who wrote back to us said that not only did they like this idea, had we done it earlier, it would have taken them less time to buy cloud. And that's because what that affirmed to us was that the value we were offering was in fact the guarantee. It was the insurance product. It was not the fact that we had a pretty UI. And so that made this even easier. And then the second thing that I mentioned is we talked to prospective customers. We talked to a bunch of enterprises that we are currently in early conversations with. And we learned from them that one of the things that was blocking the adoption of Prefect in their organizations was that there are people who just require UI and who weren't ready to take the step of going through, with us and signing up and forming the relationship to get access to the UI when they weren't sure if they wanted to move forward or not. So there's a number of companies where there's a bunch of teams who love Prefect Core, who sit right next to teams that just won't consider it without a UI. And so what we've learned is that by giving them that UI, by open sourcing it, we unlock the opportunity to serve an entire enterprise, which is pretty awesome. So for all of these reasons, to be completely honest with you, we're sort of thinking we should have done this from day one.
That's incredible. And what's so interesting about this is that it basically took a pandemic to really force you to reevaluate all your assumptions and rederive them from first principles to arrive at something that you found to be true, but actually also found to be true regardless of any ongoing pandemic.
That's exactly right. It's a very weird situation. And I think it's a good illustration of one of the principles that we have at Prefect, which is we don't allow something that I call inertial thinking. And inertial thinking is basically when you say that you're doing something because you used to do it, right? That's a terrible reason to do something. You should always be willing to reevaluate it and admit that you made a mistake, or admit it doesn't have to be a mistake. It could have been the best decision under the prior information set. But now with some switching cost, there could be an even better outcome if you took a different path. And so for us, this is a really good example of that. And the interesting thing is that one of the assumptions that went into this, which is that a customer growth was going to slow as a consequence of the economy, so far has turned out not to be true at all. Now, partially that's for the reason I mentioned, where we've begun to see this reduction in sales cycle. But last week was one of the best commercial weeks our company ever had. We didn't change anything yet. We hadn't done the open source yet. All that happened was, I think, our message that our software can, in hours, which is how we time our POCs, deliver efficiencies, really resonated. And that's just this fascinating thing. And I think that's a struggle for not just us, but any company that has an open source business model is going to struggle with this balance. What should be given away? What should be kept as a proprietary feature? How do you justify that to your customers and to your ecosystem? And also, how do you appropriately price that in a fair way, in a way that can still deliver real value to all parties?
So are there any rules that you think you can apply, not just from your specific case, but to open source companies more in general?
I think that's a fabulous question. I wish I had a better answer for you. I think in some way, everyone is figuring out the rules of open source and open source companies. We have been mostly an open source company. Now we are becoming more of an open source company. And from our point of view, this is only going to be a better thing for us. But I know that there are companies out there who absolutely under no circumstances would open source a piece of their stack. So I think you really have to believe in open source. You have to be part of an open source community. Look, when Chris White, who's our CTO, when he joined Prefect, one of the first things we agreed is that the number one rule of how we were going to run Prefect's open source community was to be nice. It's not about technical knowledge. It's not about support. It's not about, you know, triage or issues or PRs or anything like that. The number one rule of how to run a good open source community is to be nice. And that is probably not something that someone would think of if they had not been part of open source communities in the past. But that is how we build a welcoming community. And we have this phenomenal community. I'm really proud of the community we've been able to build around Prefect's open source. But again, it's an example of just something you have to sort of experience to know. So I sort of wish I could pretend to you like, oh yes, Thomas, these are the rules that we know we're going to follow to be a successful open source company. I think in all honesty, we're figuring that out as well. As a young company, the best that we can do right now is to work with our trusted partners to know affirmatively where we're delivering value to them, and then do our best to ensure that we create this wonderful product that with no compromise does what it's supposed to do.
I remember on another podcast, I'll put it in the show notes, but there was a similar discussion around, well, how do you build successful open source software companies? And the response was, well, the same way you build any successful software company, by building amazing software that's useful to people. It doesn't matter whether it's open source or not. And I think that really resonates is, well, yeah, if you build something that is helpful and useful to people and creates value, there is a company that you can build around this. And having the open source just provides additional advantages. Of course, it also creates some more difficult decisions, but nonetheless, the benefit outweighs the downsides.
I think that's right. At the end of the day, our goal is to just build software that solves a problem and does it really well. And it does it well enough that it saves enough time or enough money on someone's part that they're willing to pay for that software in order to not incur the cost on their own end. And I think this is, again, why looking back at my own experiences that led up to Prefect and even building Prefect originally to solve my own problem, not as a company at all mean that this is a tool whose sole purpose in life started as making things easier. Prefect was not designed to be sold. No investment was made that was predicated on it looking a certain way or being sold to a certain group in a certain way. It was just a tool that I came up with because I was so upset with my inability to use Airflow for data science that I just needed a better way, and I knew there had to be one. And now, 3 years later, we have this wonderful ecosystem that sprung up because it turns out that people like good software. They like software that's easy to use, and they like software that solves their problems. And so is Prefect perfect? No, we have work to do. We have a lot of work to do. We have so many cool features and stuff we're working on, and the team is excited to build them. We've got a lot we need to put into this product. But does it go out? Does it solve the problems that we set out to solve? Absolutely, it does. And now with this new open source push, it solves them even more for more people for free. And so that's amazing for us. If we can like vastly disproportionately substitute user growth for customer growth at this stage of our company, that's a huge win. And I'm very excited to see that happen.
And what I also thought was really fascinating, what you said about COVID-19 is that, well, one thing, you assumed that just sales would go down or slow down significantly. And well, first, that didn't turn out to be correct. So it's not that just the economy stops, but it is that many companies are now looking to reduce costs. So that seems that like there definitely is a lesson in there. And the other one is that you can use this time to question your principles and don't just basically freeze, but try and pivot to some extent to adjust to this new world out there. So what do you think are like some also generalizable lessons of startups or maybe even more established companies of how to operate in this new pandemic world?
The first thing that we're looking for is stability and some sense of a path forward. And if we turn now to more of a business lens for 1 second, I think it's a reasonable assumption that business as usual, or at least business on, say, February 29th, is not going to cut it today on March 29th as we record this. The world is just too different for that statement to be true. And I think that to the extent that a company is able to persevere through these traumatic events in the short term, that company is fooling itself if it thinks the same business model it had a month ago is still appropriate for the environment we find ourselves in today. Now, there are many outcomes here, right? We may find ourselves with economies turned all back on, say 6 months from now, and those business models can come back and those ways of doing business can come back. But that's just not appropriate for how a startup should look at the world now. And so I think that this idea of inertial thinking and being so opposed to it has helped us so much. I would like to think it would help other companies a lot, but it's a deeply uncomfortable thing to do. I think it's especially uncomfortable when you find yourself doing it for the first time in an environment like we have today, because you may feel that you lack the intuition for how to really know, am I doing this right? Am I overreacting? Am I moving in the right direction? How do I channel check this? How do I assess the validity of my assumptions? How do I assess the validity of the choices I'm going to make? And so this is one of those times, they happen every now and then, where I'm really glad to have had the risk management training that I've had, where I waste a hell of a lot of time in normal times worrying about situations like this and questioning my assumptions and how we're operating as a consequence of those assumptions. And so I didn't take any pleasure in sitting down and saying, okay, need a new set of assumptions for a new world. But having written them all down and looked at them and said, oh my, the obvious thing we need to do is open source more of our stack, that became a really easy thing to put into practice. So I think this is, you know, when they say startups are nimble, large companies are not, I think that this is the moment they're talking about. They're not really saying that startups are going to run around and just try a million things. And I mean, first of all, who would fund an activity like that? That's just insane. What they're really saying is that in a moment when the assumptions change, a startup is going to be very quickly able to adjust to that. A larger company is not. A larger company has no choice but to slowly turn. That, for us, has been the double-edged sword of this situation. We are a young company that has its own pros and cons. We try to turn that to advantage as much as possible. And we hope that that leads us to make good business decisions. But we also don't want to let down this open source community that we have. So if we have a chance to do both, strengthen our business as a consequence of the reach we can have and the way we can benefit people with our software, and also give more to our open source community, it's just this great win-win. And I'm just glad we had the opportunity to do it.
So like most other tech companies, you basically also switch to just everyone work from home. And I know that you and I both had previous times in our careers where we worked from home. So I'm just curious to hear what are some of the techniques that you have developed based on your own experiences and having done that, that might be helpful for other companies that are just making that switch for the first time?
Sure. So I think the most important thing at the individual level, and you and I think know this well from our past, as you mentioned, is you need to separate home and work. And that separation can almost, you know, it can be completely artificial. When I was a remote employee, but had the ability to visit some of the local businesses that are unfortunately closed right now, that meant I commuted to my home office. I got up, I went to the cafe, I read the paper, and then I came back home and started my day. And that was, that created the separation. Today, it can be hard to go out to a small business, unfortunately, like that. So find that separation at home, make coffee, get dressed, have the shower, work out, whatever it is to create a situation so you don't literally roll out of bed into your office. I think for me personally, it was the number one most important thing as an individual. As a company, again, I wish I could say that we had figured this out. I don't know if we figured it out, but I think we're doing some really great things. We have someone in our office, Brian, who's sort of been appointed as our work from home czar, as it were. And what he's been doing is, you know, organizing as many virtual events as possible, social events for our company. So whether that's meditation, lunch, happy hour. Last Friday night, we had our first movie night. And we all watched, we watched The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, of course. I voted that we watch it every week, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to get it for a role. Events like that, just to bring folks together. Everyone responds to the situation in a different way. For some people, this is business as usual. Prefect has some remote employees who are always remote. And for others, this is a deeply uncomfortable time for emotional reasons, for logistical reasons, for many different reasons. And so we always want to make sure that we have some kind of grounding and commonality to bring everyone together. One shout out I'll give is to a company called Tandem, which makes a piece of software for really rapid voice chat and screen sharing. We adopted Tandem many months ago at Prefect because we have a distributed engineering team, but we only really started using it when the entire team was remote. And their product's just been fantastic. And so for what it's worth, just wanted to sort of thank them publicly for the work that they do. We've always taken the attitude at Prefect, because we have some remote employees, we've taken the attitude that as soon as you have at least one person remote, your whole company needs to act as if it's remote. Because the most terrible thing in the world is to have two tiers of employees, some that have access to co-located information and some that don't. So for us, that means we got in the habit early of making sure every conversation is documented in Slack and writing things down. And we have a really great handbook and things like that. So all of a sudden, those documentation practices, even around things that you don't think matter, become really important, especially for an engineering team, because that will start to become sort of the institutional knowledge, the distributed institutional knowledge of the company. And so now that everybody is remote, we've really leaned into that, and tools like Tandem make it really easy to get back some of the, hey, can I talk to you for a second, moments that would otherwise be lost because of just the frictions of reaching out to somebody and getting in touch with them.
And what I find really interesting about all these companies now switching to remote, but the whole world really changing its ways, is that I think it's going to drive so much innovation in these things that have already started happening, right? So, we have had not many, but quite a few companies who are remote companies, some even remote first companies, like GitLab. And another aspect is we had, for a long time, people were saying how ridiculous it is for conferences that there's all these thousands of people flying in and then flying out once the weekend is over, just the cost on the CO2. So all of those things are now forced to really accelerate, right? A lot of companies are forced to try out remote work that would have never considered it before. And I think one positive outcome of all of this could be that once we endure this pandemic, that we still have all these things in place and all these innovations that have come out of this. So I think we will just be left with a whole bunch of really interesting new ways of doing things and a more flexible and eco-friendly world.
I totally agree with you. I'm so curious to see how it plays out. We recently hired a really wonderful developer named Laura Lorenz. And part of what Laura is working on or was working on was our conference presence. And we were going to be at PyData Miami, of course, and PyCon. And as those get alternatively canceled or delayed or whatever, there's an opportunity to be discouraged. But instead, we're looking for new ways to repurpose the materials and the work that we prepared. Laura started a few weeks ago. She started an online, what she called the Contributors Cantina for Prefect. And, you know, that's one of those things where it's so amazing to see each week more and more people show up, and we have ideas that are being generated and folks starting to work together. We're going to still have our virtual PyCon sprint. And so it is cool, as you're saying, to see how we adapt to this new reality and how we try not to lose some of the tangible benefits that otherwise could evaporate if we just kind of shrugged and said, oh, well, I guess that's not happening and with our lives.
Jeremiah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Thomas. A lot of fun.